some people came in when we sang that. Good job.
Yes. Yes.
I know. I was thinking that too. Yes, we'll do that next time. Be here and remind us. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. We have, actually, we just have one announcement today, and it's a special announcement from the youth. So I believe it's somewhere amongst the people now coming into the congregation. Okay, come up here and use the microphone, please. Yes. You have a robust voice, but microphone.
Picks up the crinkling of the paper. Come join the LCUC High School Youth Group after service in the social hall for our annual spaghetti luncheon. All plates, adult plates, are $8.50 and $5 for children. All proceeds of this will benefit our service trip to Appalachia this summer, where we'll be helping rebuilding homes for people in need. So, thank you.
In the words of Reverend Theodore Parker, be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space, its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth, its ritual, works of love, its profession of faith, divine living. Come, let us worship here together. Please take just a moment to say hello or to introduce yourself to your neighbor.
We light this flame and we know that together, we together are the vessel for the sacred fire. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing the first hymn, number 26, Holy, Holy, Holy. Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with a spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Christy Ehler, not Barb Adams, as listed in the order of service. I'm the worshiper up today and worship associate. And as a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, friends, and members, wherever they are on life's journey, on whatever background you may have, you will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation, and as announced earlier, spaghetti in the social hall after the service. And while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes additional announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to everyone joining in. Please take a moment at this point in service to silence your electronic noisemakers. And again, welcome to everyone who is here with us this morning. We are very pleased and grateful that you've chosen to celebrate and worship with us.
Thank you.
One of the ways that we help to care for our wider community is by contributing to local food pantries financially and by collecting non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. So if you've brought any food to share, please bring it forward, place it in the basket, or ask a child to bring it forward. And I invite all the children to come forward to enjoy a story.
And you all are going to want to face the screen.
Victoria, thank you so much for joining me for Mommy Pig's Online Storytime. I have another great story to share with you today. It's called When Pigs Fly, and it was written by Valerie Coleman with artwork by Roger. When Pigs Fly. In a meadow near the city lived a cow named Ralph. Ralph wanted his dad to buy him a bicycle. But Ralph, his dad said, cows don't ride bikes. Not yet they don't, Ralph replied. Ralph asked and asked and asked his dad for a bike, but his dad said no and no and no. Finally he said, okay, Ralph, I'll buy you a bike when pigs fly. Ralph thought about that. Then one day, while playing with some friends, he had an idea. But first he had to learn how to fly a helicopter. Why do you want to fly a helicopter, Ralph? Asked his friend Morris. Cows don't fly. Not yet they don't, said Ralph. Morris looked puzzled. Ralph explained, my dad said he'd buy me a bike when pigs fly. But Ralph, Morris said, pigs don't fly. Not yet they don't, said Ralph. Morris looked even more puzzled. Ralph laughed. If I learn to fly a helicopter, he said, I can take some pigs for a ride. Then I can have a bike. Ralph, Morris said, cows don't ride bikes. Not yet they don't, said Ralph. The next day, Ralph went to the airport. He saw a woman loading suitcases onto an airplane. Excuse me, said Ralph, is there someone here who can teach me how to fly a helicopter? Millie looked a little surprised. Bill can, she said, but cows don't fly helicopters. Not yet they don't, Ralph smiled. Ralph went to see Bill. Why do you want to learn to fly a helicopter? Bill asked. When I learn to fly a helicopter, I can take some pigs for a ride, Ralph explained. My dad said that when pigs fly, I can have a bike. Ralph, said Bill, do you know that cows don't ride bicycles? Not yet they don't, said Ralph. Every day that week, Bill showed Ralph how to fly a helicopter. Ralph learned to fly up and down and backwards and forwards. He even learned how to fly in circles. It was a very exciting week for Ralph. Sometimes it was exciting for Bill, too. As soon as his lessons were finished, Ralph went to see his friends, Julia and Margaret. Can I take you for a helicopter ride yet? Julia's eyes opened wide. Margaret's mouth opened wide. But Ralph, they said, we're pigs. Pigs don't fly. Not yet they don't, answered Ralph. The very next morning, Ralph took Julia and Margaret for a ride in a helicopter. The circles made Julia a little dizzy, and Margaret liked going up better than down, but they both had fun. When the helicopter landed, Ralph said thank you to Julia and Margaret. I have to get home, he said. My dad is going to buy me a bike. A bike, said Margaret, but Ralph was already gone. Ralph, Julia called after him, cows don't ride bikes. His answer came back to them, not yet they don't. The end.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the book, and I'll see you next time for Mommy Pig Storytime. In the meantime, remember, Reading keeps your mind and imagination growing.
Thank you all for sharing that story with us. May the light and love of our chalice lead you today and every day. And if you all would wait and follow our lantern bearer to the classrooms, and if you would help us sing the children out, the words are written in your order of service. Wisconsin had three churches and a Buddhist temple. It was a cold fall, and all four buildings were plagued by squirrels looking for a warm place. The Buddhists tried living in harmony with the squirrels and were soon being overrun. The Quaker meeting tried trapping them humanely and taking them to the woods nearby, but the furry pests quickly returned. The Presbyterians decided it was simply predestined that the squirrels would be there and resolved to tolerate them. The Unitarian Universalist, however, solved the problem rather quickly. They simply invited them all into worship and told them it was time to pass the offertory baskets. They haven't seen a squirrel since. Don't be squirrely. The morning offering will now be given and received. Thanks for these gifts given and received for the life and the work of this community. This is the time in our service where we share our joys and our concerns. And we do this in several ways. We light candles before the service quietly, and during the service we speak our joys and concerns aloud and we light candles. Would anyone who has a joy or a sadness to share Please raise your hand. The ushers will bring you a microphone. I'd like to light the first candle today, a candle of concern for Isaac Krill, who is ill again, little Isaac, who is usually in the back with his mom. He is ill again and he is in children's, so please hold the Krill family in your hearts.
This is Harold. I want to talk about a joy, my joy for having been part of this community, on and off, mostly on, for almost 10 years. Today is likely one of my last times to be with you, as I'm moving to Huntley, Illinois, to live closer to my daughter. I think now how fortunate it was that we found one another. To sing in Karen's choir, to study philosophers with Gus, to hear meaningful messages from the pulpit, the list goes on and on. I love this church for its members and how they continually show concern for others, typified by stepping up to the new program to help homeless in the area. While concerns do come my way, LCUUC has been a continuing joy to me. I cherish my time with you. Know that the welcome mat is always out in Huntley and that the office has the address.
This is Kathy, a candle of remembrance for my mother-in-law who passed away a week ago today.
And I'm Sue. Can you light a candle for a good friend of Abby's who's going through a pretty rough patch, and for his friends and family who are trying to figure out how to be there to support him.
This is Jim. Janice and I have a joy, and that is Julia and her boyfriend Eli came to visit us.
I have a joy. This is Dave. I have a joy that Angel was able to report to me this morning, and she's here today, but the help she's reached out for has been meaningful to her and helpful to her in her current situation and her family.
And we light the last candle today for all of those joys and all of those sorrows which are deeply felt, but which have not been named here today.
Today's first reading is a blog post from Reverend Forrest Church. Author of Love and Death, My Journey Through the Valley of Shadow. Death is central to my definition of religion. Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. We are not the animal with advanced language or tools as much as we are the religious animal. Knowing that we must die, we question what life means. The answers we arrive at may not be religious answers, but the questions death forces us to ask are, at heart, religious questions. Where did I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? What is life's purpose? What does all this mean? All of these questions obviously have special urgency for me now that I have been told I have only months left in my life. Hearing word of my diagnosis of terminal cancer, a longtime parishioner who has known her full share of death wrote me of her heartache. My heart has been broken again, Camille wrote, and for that I am overwhelmingly thankful. Without love, this would not be possible. She had it just right, and she and others in my congregation made me think that I needed to write one last book, one that would consolidate my thoughts on love and death. Fighting the most convincing deadline of my life, I nonetheless experienced great joy in writing Love and Death. I discovered, in confronting my diagnosis, that death is not life's goal, only life's terminus. The goal is to live in such a way that our lives will prove worth dying for. This is where love comes into the picture. The one thing that can't be taken from us, even by death, is the love we give away before we go. Here ends the first reading.
Please join me in a silent moment of meditation or the spirit of prayer.
Our second reading today is an excerpt from the sermon, The Transient and Permanent in Christianity, by Reverend Theodore Parker. Theodore Parker was a reforming American minister of the Unitarian Church, an abolitionist, and a transcendentalist. And he said in his famous sermon, "Let us look at this matter a little more closely. In actual Christianity, that is, in the portion of Christianity which is preached and believed, there seem to have been, ever since the time of its earthly founder, two elements, the one transient, the other permanent. The one is the thought, the folly, the uncertain wisdom, the theological notions, the impiety of man. The other, the eternal truth of God. These two bear perhaps the same relation to each other that the phenomena of outward nature, such as sunshine and cloud, growth, decay, and reproduction, bear to the great law of nature, which underlies and supports them all. As in that case, more attention is commonly paid to the particular phenomena than to the general law. So in this case, more is generally given to the transient in Christianity than to the permanent therein. It must be confessed, though with sorrow, that transient things form a great part of what is commonly taught as religion. An undue place has often been assigned to forms and doctrines, while too little stress has been laid on the divine life of the soul, love to God, and love to man. Religious forms may be useful and beautiful. They are so when they speak to the soul and answer a want thereof. In our present state, some forms are perhaps necessary, but they are only the accident of Christianity, not its substance. They are the robe, not the angel, who may take another robe, quite as becoming and useful. One sect has many forms, another none. Yet both may be equally Christian in spite of the redundance or the deficiency. They are part of the language in which religion speaks and exists, with few exceptions, wherever man is found. In our calculating nation, In our rationalizing sect, we have retained but two of the rites so numerous in the early Christian church, and even these we have attenuated to the last degree, leaving them little more than a specter of the ancient form. Another age may continue or forsake both, may revive old forms or invent new ones to suit the altered circumstance of the times, and yet be Christians quite as good as we, or our fathers of the Dark Ages. Whether the apostles designed these rites to be perpetual seems a question which belongs to scholars and antiquarians, not to us as Christian men and women. So long as they satisfy or help the pious heart, so long as they are good. Looking behind or around us, we see that the forms and rites of the Christians are quite as fluctuating as those of the heathens, from whom some of them have been, not unwisely, adopted by the earlier church. Again, the doctrines that have been connected with Christianity and taught in its name are quite as changeable as the form. Here ends the second reading. Now, if you please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our hymn, number 111, Light of Ages.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. I ain't afraid of your churches. I ain't afraid of your temples. I ain't afraid of your praying. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. Rise up to your higher power, free up from the fear that will devour you. Watch out for the ego of the hour. The ones who say they know it are the ones who will impose it on you. Rise up and hear a higher story. Free up from the gods of war and glory. Watch out for threats of purgatory. The spirit of the wind doesn't make a killing off of sin and Satan. I ain't afraid of your Bible. I ain't afraid of your Torah. I ain't afraid of your Quran. Don't let the letter of the law obscure the spirit of love. It's killing us. I ain't afraid of your churches. I ain't afraid of your temples. I ain't afraid of your praying. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. Holly Neer said that. Mahatma Gandhi said it a little more succinctly, a little more bluntly. I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ. But it isn't just Christianity. Organized religion as a whole has taken a tremendous hit since the 50s. And while 92% of Americans say they believe in a God or a higher power, one-fifth of American adults don't identify with any denomination, and that number goes to 1 in 3 when you limit the group to adults under 30. 22% of Americans don't attend any type of religious service. 55% of adults born after 1969 say they grew up without religion in their house. A new survey by the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religious and Public Life finds that many of our country's 46 million unaffiliated adults are religious or spiritual in some way. These are the nuns that we all keep hearing about. 2/3 of them say they believe in God. More than half say they have a deep connection with nature and the earth. And more than 1/3 use the cliche, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. 1 in 5 prays every day. These same unaffiliated, these same nuns say loudly and clearly that they think churches and other religious institutions benefit society. They strengthen community bonds, they aid the poor, and they don't want to go. So why aren't they coming? Why are we here and they're not? With few exceptions, the unaffiliated say they don't want a religion that would be right for them. Religious organizations are too concerned with money, with manipulating power, too focused on rules, too involved in politics. I ain't afraid of your churches. I ain't afraid of your temples. I ain't afraid of your praying. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God. And you know what? Sometimes I am too. When I hear the stories of pulpit abuse, of church abuse, ministers who sleep in the wrong places, ministers who hurt children, ministers who spew hatred from a pulpit or use what should be a sacred call to preach politics, to lead secular initiatives to support particular candidates from the pulpit. And when I hear these stories, I am afraid of what we do in the name of a God. But those churches, those incidents, those ministers, those people who pervert and destroy religion for their own gain, they are not religion. And it's easy to lose sight of that. They're people making mistakes. And religion is important. And this is the piece that people are missing. Religion is important because, unlike spirituality, it is about relationship. And let me unpack that a little more. Spirituality is personal. No one, and I mean no one, can come up with an exact definition for spirituality. The best that we can do is to recognize it as a process of personal transformation based on a set of ideals. Your spirituality is your journey. It's what you believe to be true, the values that you hold. One of the best ways to describe it I've ever heard is that it is your belief about what makes up the most highly evolved version of humanity and how you see yourself approximating that ideal. So how do you see yourself imitating Christ or Buddha, Muhammad, a perfect piece of the natural world? As Ralph Waldo Emerson and the Transcendentalists explored the idea of spirituality divorced from religion, they were influenced by the philosopher and writer Friedrich Schleiermacher. And he came up with a tongue twister. He said, the individual's intuition of truth should be accepted as the criteria for truth. So, your perception of truth, your deep understanding of truth becomes the reality, becomes the truth. Personal belief began to be accepted as a valid spiritual perspective. In the late 18th and early 19th century, the first translation of Hindu texts appeared, and the Transcendentalists ate them up. They were absorbed into our mix of ideas. They began to endorse Universalist and Unitarianist ideas, leading to the roots of our own Unitarian Universalism, supporting the idea that there must be truth in all spiritual beliefs, since for them a loving God would redeem all living beings, not just Christianity. But spirituality is a belief, not a practice. Having beliefs about the ultimate nature of reality, which are non-destructive, which help to make positive change in our lives and our world, that is wonderful. But that is your creed, and your creed is yours alone. It is your deeds which speak for you. Your creed is not enough. Spirituality alone, without a living show of what that means, is not enough. Right now, in 2014, the average American drives almost half an hour to work every day, one way. We work about 8 hours a day during the week and 5.5 on weekends. And here's the fun statistic. Media consumption, radio, television, movies, computer, social media, web surfing, for the average adult, excluding time at work, is 15 hours a day. 15. Even when we're playing sports, even when we're working at the gym, we're being bombarded by radio, by television. Children under 18 spend 44.5 hours a week online outside of school. Constant barrages of images. We don't live where we work anymore. When we aren't working, we're buried under stimuli that we didn't make and have nothing to do with and are simply consumers of. We're interacting with sounds and pictures and games and phones, Facebook, a million more bits of the modern world. And while we may have communities that we participate in through the internet, through work, these are not the communities of people that will support us for our entire life. In southwestern Ohio, where I spent the last 20 years, there are clusters of last names you hear often. Stoltzfus, Hirschberger, Yoder, Hochstetler, Troyer, Schrock. These are the most common Amish names carried by Amish people who make their homes in Adams, Brown, Claremont, and Clinton counties. And I'll tell you, it was a heck of a culture shift when I moved here and saw bike lanes. Just as we here in Wisconsin get adjusted to seeing bike lanes with someone riding a bike with a helmet, there no one is surprised to see buggies. And instead of bike racks outside a church or outside of a shop, you have a hitching post. It is common to see a buggy and team hitched up outside of McDonald's. It's also, unfortunately, quite common to have to tell your boss, sorry I was late, buggy in front of me, skittish horses, two-lane road, sorry. I made candles and soap with Amish friends, helped butcher beef, even helped butcher ostriches, which are a meat idol out there. Traded bread and cake recipes, complimented bonnets. And one day I was sitting with Amish friends drinking coffee and waiting for bread to rise. And my friend's husband came in from the field where he'd been working. There'd been a small accident. One of the wagon wheels had cracked. And here's the fun part. He wanted to know, would I drive him over to the wheelwright to drop it off and get a loaner wheel until it was replaced? Oh, and could he borrow my cell phone to call the community phone to let them know he was coming? And I realized in that moment that maybe I didn't know as much about the Amish as I thought I did. They didn't have phones, but they were allowed to have a community phone on a pole. They didn't drive, but could get me to ride them up for a pizza. Their stores had electricity, their shops refrigerators, but their houses had icebox and candle lanterns. Okay, what was the deal? I didn't get it. So we went and got the wheel, and if you've never been with an Amishman going, you know, can I get my loaner wheel? You don't know joy. It's like watching somebody negotiating for a loaner car, only much, much simpler. So we got him in the loaner wheel, and we got back, and he put it on. And I realized I needed to do some reading. And I found a book by Tony Campolo called Following Jesus Without Embarrassing God. And surprisingly, it was able to answer my questions, and the answers were incredible. Campolo said, most of us became familiar with the Amish of the United States as a result of the film Witness. Until then, we didn't really know who or what they were, except those strange people in black. We learned that they avoid modern technology. They have no TVs in their homes, no telephones in their homes. There's electricity into the barn, but not the house. Such a lifestyle to us seems harsh and rigorous. But an Amish bishop once explained why it is that the Amish live this way. He suggested that most technology had, in fact, had a negative impact on people's lives. Television was a good example for him. It brought violence and poor ethical values into our homes, so much so that many people would like to quit watching TV, but find that they simply can't. Does this mean the Amish are against modern technology? And believe it or not, here's the answer. No, not at all. They simply want to keep it in its proper place. The Amish weren't against telephones. In fact, the bishop had had one installed down the street from his house on a pole. It was quite handy to have in an emergency, to call distant family or friends. But why would you bring such a thing into your house? Telephones intrude on the most important moments of life, the bishop said, the most precious. What if you're talking to your children? What if you're sharing something important with your wife? If the phone rings, you will allow it to interrupt what you are saying. What if your family is at prayer? Would you stop and answer a phone? He was shocked at the idea. And then he smiled and said, you could be with your wife in your bedroom, and you would let a phone possibly interrupt that? Why would you risk that? He was shocked at the idea. Similarly, electricity could be a good thing in its proper place. The Amish in his community had electricity in their barns to refrigerate the milk, but not in their houses, because it disrupted the natural rhythm of their lives. With electricity, people stayed up late instead of going to bed. Rather than being together, rather than talking together. With electricity, people listened to radios and watched television. And these things involved them with the outside world, not taught them about, but made them more concerned about the outside world than their community, their own Amish community. So what about tractors? If they use electricity, why not tractors? And this one hit me hard. The bishop said that with a tractor, a person can plow a field all on their own. They don't need anyone. What a wonderful thing, not to need anyone. But using a horse-drawn plow, the whole family has to help. Rejecting the trailer and the tractor lets you create family solidarity, gives you an excuse to help one another. No other reason. Can you imagine that? I don't want to use this tool because it makes it too easy. It makes me not need any of you. And I don't want that. The Amish have perhaps given more thought to this issue than most of us have. 200 years ago, our towns were much more like Amish communities. The doctor and the minister and the librarian, they all lived up the street from one another and among the people they served. If someone in town died, everybody went to the funeral. If a business failed, if a store failed, and a family was hungry, everyone knew about it. Most people tried to help because it's easy to help when you know that it's the Marvin children who need something, not just somebody's children. It's easy to help when you know them. Communities were interlaced. Their lives were intertwined. Enlightened self-interest, if nothing else, made you not be a jerk. But today we live half an hour from where we work. Today we form groups around our hobbies, our children's school activities, our internet interests. We work with people who say, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. Humans are hardwired to seek out community. But today, most of our communities align with only a little of our lives. We have friends in ski club and baking club and our book club. But these clubs are perhaps not the best place to explore all of our deepest ideas about the meaning of life, the meaning of death, the meaning of love, the transient and the permanent elements of religion. Religion is a special type of community event. A continuum of experience where the Amish are at one far end and we are perhaps the other end. Religion is a collection of beliefs or practices that relate humanity to an order of existence. More simply, any religion is a set of spiritual beliefs, practices based on spirituality, and it helps us to live based on where we believe we as humans fall on a scale from meaningless to divine. Who are we? Religion is the community experience of shared spirituality. It's where we find out if our own beliefs about the world help to create or destroy harmony between people. And I would say to you that it is the only place that we get to do that in such a concise manner. In a world where most of our communities are limited, going to church or joining a religion lets us join something far greater than ourselves, bring our whole self to the conversation. Spirituality without religion is easy. Everyone has personal beliefs. But every one of us, even the happiest or the most easygoing soul ever born, has a yearning for more. What does it all mean? What do my beliefs mean in the great scheme of things? How do they fit? Art and music and books and poetry and plays are written to help us connect with other human beings. Psychology and sociology look at who we are and how we coexist, and we struggle to do it in ways that bring meaning to our lives. Religion helps us to find that meaning. When we come together in community dedicated to deep connection, to support one another through the unlit places in our lives, something happens. We become players in a greater story, beacons of light for one another in ways that change and mold us and lead us in new directions. Spirituality is personal. It's an inner dialogue that cannot be shared by its very nature. Religion is the shared expression of the values and rituals we find meaningful, based on our spiritualities, which support or parallel each other, and which call us to similar lived expressions of our faith. Spiritual but not religious has become a cliche, a shorthand way of saying, I don't want to bother with other people. I just want to believe what I believe and go out into the world. And I am saying to you that if we want to change the world, spiritual but not religious is not enough. We have to learn to be in community one with another. We have to invite others into that community of parallel spiritualities. Dare to believe in the truth of your heart. Who am I to tell you otherwise? But it is in sharing the moments that we are called to by our spirituality that we share our humanity. And religion is the ultimate place to begin that sharing. Because I ain't afraid of your churches. I ain't afraid of your temples. I ain't afraid of your praying. I ain't afraid. Amen.
We carry this flame in our hearts to light our way as we create a community of sacred relationship. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our final hymn, number 100, Peace Like a River.
Take the religion of your hearts into the world and be blessed as you live your sacred truth. Peace, and may it be so. And if everyone could exit, if you're going to the spaghetti dinner, through the opposite door that we normally do, the door I am walking toward now because I went to the wrong side.